Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Welcome to another edition of Gaming Chords. Gaming Chords is proud to be a part of the STEM Dadia Network with our sister shows, Startup Radio and STEM Voices. But today, it's a new episode of Gaming Chords, and I'm excited because we have two guests that are going to talk about the future of virtual reality, or the present day status of virtual reality. And they're trying to make, with their company Ilium VR, make certain games more realistic in what you're doing in the virtual space. And, you know, I think we dive right into it and let them talk about themselves and Ilium and virtual reality, and we'll just have a great conversation. So welcome, Sebastian Sabora and Jasmine Olinger. Did I pronounce your names correctly?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
So, Sebastian, you're CEO of Ilium VR, and Jasmine, you're Chief Operating Officer. Let's take a step back, and how did the two of you come together, or how did Ilium come about?
Ilium sort of started, we were in college. There were three founders. We were computer science students at RPI, and we started going to hackathons together. We actually started a hackathon together at our school, and Sebastian had this idea for a long time, since high school actually, to do this project. And when we were trying to think of hackathon projects, he brought it up when we decided to do it. I think it was in 2014 we started at a hackathon, got our first prototype, thought it was a good business idea, and just kept going from there.
So you met in college, and was that Rensselaer Polytechnic?
Yes.
Yep.
And that's out in New York, correct?
Yeah, for New York.
Yeah, kind of near Albany, the capital.
Yeah.
All right, and is that where Ilium's still based?
Yes.
Yep, yeah, we're right down the hill from our college. We actually, we recruit and get interns and other things like that, so we have a really good relationship with the city and the school in general.
Fantastic. Well, 2014, so 3 years later, how have things been going? Where are you in product development? I know that at one point you had an Indiegogo campaign for a dev kit. Where is Ilium now in terms of its products, its launches, and its vision?
Yeah, definitely. Great question. 3 years is kind of, it's an interesting amount of time because it's like kind of a long time for a startup, but also a really short amount of time. There's a lot of stuff that you can get done, and a lot of things that can take a long time in 3 years, especially when, you know, virtual reality is such a new industry. Kind of when we started out, there were really no controllers at all, let alone gun controllers. There weren't, you know, really even, like, a lot of the technology that's standard for virtual reality didn't even exist at the time. So there's been a lot of interesting technological pivots and business sorts of pivots that we've done over the course just to adapt to this really, really quickly moving market. We spent a lot of time, you know, doing R&D and just kind of developing product, making prototypes and things like that of gun controllers specifically. And kind of one of the big things that came out of that is our developer program. So last year we launched, at the beginning of the year, 2016, we launched our first developer kit, which was like, just kind of an assault rifle gun controller to get out to to game studios. And then we took a bunch of feedback from that. Kind of they told us what worked, what didn't work, you know, saw what games they were making, what experiences they were moving towards. And then we started, did a second developer kit with, you know, updating and things like that to, you know, making it wireless, solving a lot of new technical issues, kind of keeping up to date with, you know, the changes that the industry has had. So, and that was, you know, pretty much all 2016 was us focusing on those two developer kits. And then we had, as you mentioned, our Indiegogo campaign for Athena. And the campaign, you know, didn't succeed, but we still have moved forward with, you know, producing gun controllers and continue, you know, existing. And it's unfortunate that a lot of companies, they, you know, have a campaign. If the campaign succeeds, they can't move forward. But we've, you know, kind of positioned ourselves in a way that that hasn't happened to us. So now we're moving more towards, in, you know, at this point in time, moving towards arcades. So there are a lot of virtual reality arcades popping up all around the world, and they're kind of making it a lot easier for people to dip their toes into VR without spending, you know, $2,000 on a whole, you know, giant rig. So a lot of people can get the experiences of video games before they even have to make that huge investment. So that's kind of where we're turning right now and producing products while we help and, you know, get ready for the consumer market for virtual reality to grow and get bigger so that we can reach out to that market as well. So right now, the big thing is producing a product for those arcades, a rifle product that is going to be high enough quality to, you know, and realistic enough and works with all the games that they want it to work with so that we can make a really cool arcade experience for VR.
Well, let me ask you, does the product, the items that you've been working on, what platforms do they work well with or at all? I know that I've read, of course, that, you know, that you're working with the HTC Vive, but do any of them also work with the Oculus system or any of the other virtual reality systems?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I think that a good way to talk about that is the history of the market a little bit. So yeah, you're right. Right now we focus on the Vive because of how kind of open they've been with their hardware, you know, their ability to make that hardware and the software, a lot of open source stuff or at least licensable technology. But I mean, when we first started out, the only headset on the market was the Oculus, right? At the time there was only their DK1. Their first unit had only just launched and we, you know, had started using it. So that was the only thing we could work with, the only platform that we used. And the second developer kit of theirs came out with positional tracking, and that was a huge part of technology that we're lapping on, you know, getting onto. But right now, the Vive is the main focus for us.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I don't have the HTC Vive yet. My colleague, and I've actually had him on the show Gaming Chords, Ronnie Farhad, has the HTC Vive. I have the Oculus. I've been, you know, I was a Kickstarter backer of the Oculus way back when, as well as the Omni, which I finally received. And for those that don't know, the Omni through Virtuex is more or less it's like a treadmill such that you can move around, turn, and walk, run virtually in the space, and it works with the Oculus and so forth. But it's interesting that you mention the arcades, because from my perspective, that's kind of how I think the Omni pivoted too. You know, initially, its Kickstarter campaign was directed toward consumers, certainly those that were interested in and so forth. And just my impression, and I think this happens with a lot of startups and a lot of hardware developers, is the costs, the build-up costs and so forth, and then the deliverables become almost to a certain extent a barrier to get to the consumers, that the price point just isn't ultimately right. And it sounds like that kind of is where you're shifting, and these arcades are showing up, and it's a great avenue for that. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot more of the omnis. But Jasmine, from your perspective in operations and so forth, what are your thoughts on that kind of transition? I mean, will it be more than the focus on the arcades and that's the market, or do you eventually see that, following on maybe something that Sebastian said, that there will eventually be a point where individual consumers will be able to purchase the products for their enjoyment in virtual reality? Do you have any ideas on where you think the marketplace is going in that regard?
Yeah. So you've kind of got a good grasp of it. I think the arcades are just a stepping stone to build ourselves up so we can afford that big upfront cost of mass production for consumers. Because at a large quantity, something like our controller wouldn't be too expensive to produce and it wouldn't be very expensive to buy. But there's just the number of VR users out there who are looking for this specific thing is so small that I think it's better to latch on to these arcades. They can afford the small scale cost of these until VR becomes more prevalent and we can just go directly to the consumer.
Yeah, the arcades are an interesting phenomenon, and I am intrigued by it, have been intrigued by it for a while, to see how they come about. And, you know, it kind of has reminiscences of the Ready Player One fiction book, but it seems that fiction may, to a certain extent, the VR kind of arcades is becoming more of a reality. But so that's interesting. I mean, and I imagine that it is difficult to how did you find, when this is for either one of you, Sebastian or Jasmine, how did you find your manufacturer, or were you building the devices in house? Do you have a team somewhere or some company that you've teamed up with? How is it that you went from concept to getting a physical item?
Yeah, manufacturing is like a really hard question, and you know, as a lot of, you know, times you'll see like a lot of, you know, Kickstarters or other campaigns like that, manufacturing is the big thing that they get hung up on when they are really successful and get a crap ton of money. The way that we've approached it is that, you know, in-house, our primary specialization, at least early on, is in software and the electronic side of it. So that's the part where we were very, very good in understanding of how to optimize for manufacture and optimize, you know, to get a contract manufacturer for. So, I mean, starting out, if you talk about our early developer kits, I mean, most of them were made pretty much completely here in-house. The quantity was so low, and the amount of time that we were kind of rushing, like the lead times didn't make sense, the prices didn't make sense. It was much more economical for us to produce them almost 100% here. When you look at, as we move forward, and the first place that we start because of our specialty is in the electronics. And, you know, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. Actually, electronics have come, you know, far enough that you can kind of like never actually meet your contract manufacturer and just like exchange emails with somebody in China or with, you know, somebody in America even. To get some initial runs of stuff, and it takes a little bit of while because they have to make them, and there's like tooling costs, and then they have to send them to you, and you have to tell them what they did wrong, essentially, and until it gets working. And then there's, you know, other side of the coin, which we've explored, like American manufacturers, contract manufacturers for electronics, and those ones that we can easily visit and check out their facilities and see the quality control they have. And they also, you know, once you get the electronic side of it, most of the contract manufacturers actually know somebody, you know a company that they generally partner with to assemble for the mechanical side of things. So that's a relatively good way to get into like the entirety of production, because you may be approaching a contract manufacturer just for electronics, but they're like, hey, next door we've got these guys who do injection molding. So that, and also just having people, you know, advisors or other people on the team who have gone through the process makes it a lot easier to, in our experience, to go through.
Jasmine, I want to circle back to you on something, and that is, you know, our program, Gaming Chords, is a part of the broader STEM Dadia network, which trying to promote STEM, science, technology, you know, engineering, math, so forth, and particularly the involvement of young girls, young women in pursuing those avenues. And certainly I have some questions for Sebastian, which I'll turn back to and follow up on what he was just talking about. But I wanted to take a moment and ask, how did you get involved in technology and computer science? And do you have any thoughts to or messages out there to boys or girls that are interested in computer games or technology and how to go about doing that?
Yeah, so for me personally, I guess as far as computers in general, from my earliest memory, I had a computer in my house. My dad owned a software company when I was young, and so we always had, you know, a surplus of computers from his office, you know, working and not working in the house. I played video games from a young age. And really, when I was in high school, my first year of high school, I took a computer programming elective, and I liked it, and I decided that's what I was going to do. So I messed around with that a little bit in high school. I took some other classes. I took community college classes, actually, because my school didn't have a lot of programming classes. And then I came to college to study that and also to study math. I didn't really think about it from a, you know, women don't really do this until I got to college, and everyone was suddenly like, why are you doing this? You're a woman. It was just something that I like to do. So I guess as far as advice to boys or girls, I think just do what you like, and don't be discouraged, but also don't be encouraged to do something if you don't really like it.
Right.
My parents were very, you know, open with whatever me and my brother wanted to do. I think that helped a lot. They didn't try and push me into one career or another. I just sort of found what I liked and what I was good at, and I did it.
And you have said that you are a recovered World of Warcraft addict. Do you ever play World of Warcraft anymore?
Yes, I have actually relapsed, so I'm no longer recovered. I started playing World of Warcraft when I was like 11 years old, which is crazy. My brother played it. He got me into it. He was my gateway drug. But I played it all throughout high school pretty seriously. I stopped playing when I was in college. And probably like a couple months ago, I started playing again. So,
And Sebastian, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jasmine.
It's a fun game. Like all games, I think it's more important to do school, but now that I'm out of school, I have found some enjoyment in it.
Sebastian, are there games that you're fond of as well, or are you as much a game player as Jasmine?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe apples and oranges, in and out of hours of play. I think there are a lot of games that we play that are very similar, and a lot of games we play that are very different. I very much am kind of the two types of games I play are either shooters like Counter-Strike or Halo, that sort of thing, which is kind of really good for the just understanding the market and the customer, you know, of kind of the products that we're making. And then I also play a lot of like very deep and detailed like strategy games that are pretty boring to most people. Actually, Jasmine plays a couple of the same ones as well, like Crusader Kings and things like that. Like most people kind of look at the game, they're like, why are you doing that? But it's still enjoyable.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in watching my own experience playing games over the years, and then now watching my two sons play games, you know, those strategy games really do have a fascination, and I think that they're the games that you can come back to, somewhat like Dungeons and Dragons in a campaign that does not necessarily end in one day or one gameplay, it's something that you can come back and build upon. You know, and in fact, one of those games that I played on my Apple 2GS many moons ago was The Bard's Tale. And there was recently a Kickstarter project where the developer of the original Bard's Tale did a campaign to do a relaunch of a new version with the new technology and where we are today. This is probably about 30 years later or so. And I'm excited to see, certainly I backed that, and I'm excited to see where that goes. But I think that, you know, my two sons, and I see their friends as well, it's both type of games, those that you can play and you're done with immediately, and then those that you can come back and build upon. And the other thing that I've noticed is what's fascinating to me and a number of others, looking at the history of games and game development, is the Minecraft phenomena, particularly how big a phenomena it was, where you did not need great graphics. I mean, you know, it's almost like 8-16-bit graphics as opposed to lifelike. And I've just seen, you know, it's just fascinating to me that as much as the technology pushes forward, in some games you've got to have lifelike, you know, interactions with people, like the Assassin's Creed and so forth. And then you have something like Minecraft come out where the graphics kind of regresses, but yet I think it's the sandbox format, being able to play around and build and be creative, that's addictive. And do you, either of the two of you, have any comments or thoughts on kind of that whole development of the game industry and where it might be going in that regard?
Yeah, I think kind of the big thing that a lot of people have realized when you get this resurgence of like Minecraft, like I used to play a lot of Minecraft. I also pretty much every, like sometimes we go to like Mentor at like, you know, elementary schools and things like that. And like, you can see that nearly 100% of the kids play Minecraft. And we have a lot of, you know, I mean, right now we're in our demo room where all our VR rigs are set up, and we bring in kids all the time, like from, scouts or high schools and things like that. And all of them are like, oh, do you have Minecraft for VR?
I'm pretty sure I'm actually the only person in this office who hasn't played Minecraft before.
Really?
You should solve that. It's a good game.
Well, I want to stop you right there, because it sounds fantastic that you're bringing in kids and scouts to kind of show what you're doing, it sounds like. How do they reach out to you, or do you reach out to them, and what do you show them when they come through?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would say the vast majority of it is kind of inbound communication, where, like, we'll have, like, a teacher at a local school, and we'll have, you know, a leader of a, you know, a Boy Scouts troop or something like that. Will come to kind of email us because they'll see something about us on the news or something. They're like, oh, wow, virtual reality is this new thing. You know, all my kids know about it, but we don't really, haven't got a chance to play it because it's so new. Can we come by your office and just, like, see what you guys are up to? And we're like, yeah, sure, why not? Because the big thing about it, you know, one motivation is, right, it's fun to, you know, kind of give back to the community and help these kids really experience this kind of amazing thing that we're, at this point, dedicating our lives to. But also, I mean, these are the people who are going to be buying VR, you know, 5 years, 10 years.
Right.
So we're helping build the market, you know, at a level right now, so that, you know, that consumer market gets bigger. But yeah, a lot of things that we show them, sometimes it depends on the context of how we're talking to them. Sometimes we show them the stuff, like demos of what we're working on, like good gun controllers with little games. Sometimes we just show them VR in general. Like the Vive has a really cool thing called the Lab, which has a lot of fun experiences in it. And we, kids will play that for hours. Or we have a Minecraft VR that is really awesome. I mean, one of the big things that I really like about having kids here is that a lot of times VR is really intuitive for them in a way that isn't intuitive for us that have played video games, you know, since like Nintendo 64.
Or earlier. I hear there were video games before that.
Yeah.
So our history almost becomes an inhibitor to intuitively using the VR where these young children are just seem to fit right into it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, a kid in VR just assumes that they can do anything because they've never been limited by, you know, the limitations of older games. So if there's something there, they'll reach out and grab it. Whereas, you know, an experienced gamer might assume that most of the objects in their environment they can't interact with because most games previously
right.
can't interact with, like, 90% of the things that you see in the game.
Yeah, one of the ones that happened recently was we had a, I had some, like, family members, some younger girls come in to play, and they were, one of them was playing the Minecraft VR thing, and she went down into, like, the water area, like a lake or whatever, and she was kind of like, hey, I can swim. And I was like, well, yeah, you can swim in Minecraft or whatever. And she's like, no, I can, like, literally paddle my arms, like, doggy paddle or, like, do a breaststroke or whatever, and the character will swim. And, like, me, having played video games for a long time, I would have never done that. Like, there's no way I would have just, like, tried that on my own, but... It was just so intuitive to her that she just did it. And, like, those features, there are a lot of features in VR that we just never realized, but kids find them all the time because, like, they just come at it from a new approach.
What setup was that, if you don't mind me asking?
That was, we have the Vive, and then with Vivecraft.
What's Vivecraft?
Vivecraft is a little mod that added, that takes Minecraft and adds a bunch of, like, you know, software too, so it works with the Vive and with the Vive controllers.
Right, interesting. So I want to talk about an issue that I know that some of you have talked about. I think Sebastian, you have, and that is, you know, talking about video games and so forth, and then you're working on building a gun device. Have you had any negative feedback in terms of? You know, critique on actually making it more realistic for people to play that. I mean, you know, part of my response might be to lead into this is that the games already exist. I mean, the games are what they are, and you know, maybe you don't or you do want to play with the Wii controller or, you know, just an Xbox controller or what have you. But have you received any critique, or has the response been understanding in that regard?
Yeah, I would say, like, vast majority, and even when we have, like, you know, parents come in with kids and other things like that, the response has been pretty positive. I think that the, like, argument of, like, okay, are video games, like, turning our kids into, you know, murderous rampagers is, like, that has been had for the past 20 years at least. And so we're benefiting from the fact that people have, you know, come to the understanding that that is, you know, the correlation there is not as strong as people have been convinced in the past. So what we talk about mostly is how this affects our design philosophy. And so a lot of times we'll get, the way we describe it is that you got half people who want the most realistic gun ever. They want to, like, you know, not even be able to tell that they're not at the range. You know, and you've got the other half that want it to be essentially a Nerf gun. And so what we find a lot is the challenge is finding the balance between those to satisfy those two groups, to give them something that is, you know, physically immersive and provides a really good experience and, you know, has things like realistic reloading or realistic, you know, pulling the slide back or, you know, feel like you're really having that experience and you're really immersed, but it doesn't, you know, scare people away.
Right.
And I think that that's the majority where we have the conversation. We've had some people who, you know, have come up and said, hey, like, you know, like, don't let my kids play with that or, like, whatever, or have concerns about that. But I think they're by far the minority, rather, of the conversation. Most people are really enthused about the entertainment value of it and also the learning value. I mean, when you talk about, you know, gun controllers, like, why does the gun controller, it's not necessarily only a violent thing, maybe you were creating a historical reenactment of some military battle, right? And you're teaching the person to have empathy and understand what was going on in that situation. Why is it so difficult? One of the things we find, you know, often is that people will fire the whole magazine of the gun, like 30 rounds in like half a second, and they realize, like, oh, geez, like, this is hard. Like, you know, soldiers have it hard. People, you know, this is not an easy task. It goes really quickly, that sort of thing. So also creates an empathy in that sense.
Yeah, at the same time, though, we're like 100% not marketing this gun or any of our products towards children or even towards parents or saying, like, go buy this for your kids. It's, I mean, most of our audience is adults or young adults,
right.
And by no means would we tell a parent, like, you know, your concerns are silly and your kids should shoot these guns. But I think it's really up to the parents to curate what they want and don't want their kids to use. But I think.
Well,
and I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
So. Yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll circle back in just a few minutes to talking, Sebastian, how you became involved in computers and technology, and have some more thoughts on the future of gaming and virtual reality after we take a quick break from some words from our sponsors and advertisers. We'll be right back. You're listening to Gaming Courts on the STEMdadia Network.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, well, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
With Sebastian Sabora and Jasmine Ollinger of Ilium VR. And Ilium VR is out of Troy, New York, working on manufacturing devices to be used in the virtual reality gaming industry, basically to enhance the VR experience when you're playing games, particularly in shooter games and holding a gun and a device. And when we left for the break, we were talking and finishing up a discussion about the, you know, whether children, the safety, or whether video games cause people to become violent. And I think, Sebastian, you had said that, you know, that's somewhat been debunked significantly since perhaps the 80s or even a little bit after that, where there was a cry out against violence in video games. And Jasmine, you had mentioned that, you know, you're not targeting children with these devices or parents to have with their children. It's more an adult product. And I think, you know, I'd add on to that, that a lot of the responsibility in gameplay with whether children, youth, or anywhere in a household is with the parents that control the system. And I think that the parents need to be aware of the games that their children are playing. They need to be aware of the content, pay attention to the ratings, which did come out of those discussions in the 80s and so forth, and I think are helpful. Just like film ratings, the game ratings give an indication of what may or may not be appropriate. And I think it's really those that operate and have control over the game systems that need to be playing the role in determining what games, what videos, what films the children or other people in the household use. And at the same time, I thought it was really interesting, the comments that you made, that, Sebastian, that, you know, they realize how quickly, let's say, 30 rounds can go in just a second or so, and the realistic aspects of that. And one could argue, I know I don't think you all have done studies on this, but it'd be interesting to see whether that experience and the realistic aspect has even more of a, or develops more of a respect for the device, even though it's a game device, a respect for those kind of nuances. I don't know if you have any further thoughts, if either one of you has any further thoughts on any of those issues.
I think that's a good point. I think that, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is that some, you know, people are interested in using virtual reality for safety, gun safety. I mean, you know, people, one of the most important things about gun safety in general is respecting the weapon, kind of, is what you're pointing to there. And so, you know, there are a lot of applications for, in a safe environment, showing the cause and effect of weapons without having an actual weapon and having destructive power like that. So I think that kind of also lends to that as well.
Well, I think it's an interesting and cool product, an enhancement of the games that are already existing, and providing that hardware in the virtual reality space. Any thoughts on whether you, I mean, you said you're more focused on the HTC Vive. Is Oculus still a player in the VR world, or has HTC Vive kind of taken a leap forward?
Do you not really want
to say one way or the other?
I'll say from, you know, my personal opinion and experience, I'm not really a guy to take sides. I think that HTC has done a lot of great things for VR, consumer VR otherwise. Oculus, you know, with the Kickstarter, essentially kicked off this entire revolution that we have now. There are differences in each of their platforms. There's, you know, Oculus has been doing a lot with catering and creating AAA games on their platform, and Valve has been, you know, leveraging their Steam, you know, to all the relationship they have with game developers. So I think that, honestly, they're both great companies, and they're both doing really, really important things in making sure that this industry is going to grow, making sure that this future is going to be here. I think that one of the really good things that I, you know, saw talked at some point by one of the heads of Oculus, and he kind of said that there's a myth of technological inevitability where people think that just because something's possible, it's eventually going to happen. And in reality, you know, people have to work really hard to on, you know, really important technologies at the right time to make them happen. And Oculus and Valve are both doing that, and HTC. They're all doing that, and PlayStation is doing it, and Xbox, or, you know, Microsoft is throwing their hat in the ring, Samsung. And, you know, I think that's really great for all of them. It's kind of a non-answer, but that's my opinion.
I think it's spot on, and I think that, you know, there are some big companies, obviously, with Oculus having been bought out, and there's a lot of money and big companies and big investment behind pushing VR technology. And you had mentioned Steam. Are you still a licensing partner for Steam VR?
Yeah. So.
And what does that mean? What does that mean?
That's a good point. So really what it means is that we have the ability to create any of these Steam VR hardware with the Lighthouse tracking, which, you know, for those who might not know, Lighthouse is the system by which all of the Vive technology, the headset and the controllers, can track themselves in 3D space. Essentially what it means is that we have the ability to make those devices from scratch. We can make anything of any shape that we want. And that, you know, that means a little bit less now that the tracker, the Vive tracker, is out, and you can kind of just strap that onto, you know, a lot of devices. But it also, you know, the tracker only does so much. And when you have very specific applications that you need, and you know, say you need to make a device that has a very specific form factor, has very specific requirements, the tracker is not going to satisfy that. So building these controllers from scratch is a really strong capability.
Sebastian, how did you become involved with technology? I know that you were a programming mentor at Albany High School and a robotics team, and you're still involved in robotics, I believe, or model rockets as well. But how did your interest in technology develop? Was it similar to Jasmine's and having computers in the household, or was there some different track?
Yeah, it's kind of really different, I think. When I grew up, you know, we didn't really have computers, we didn't really have internet, really, until I was kind of like 15. I got my first like legitimate computer that I could actually use for anything when I was like in the ninth or tenth grade, I think. In terms of like my access at the home, and in terms of like people around me having computers and all sort of stuff, I wasn't really involved with that at all. But I think there was a kind of a technical like mindset to some, you know, people around me. My grandfather being a big one, he kind of always pushed me and my cousins and my brothers to approach problems in a technical way. Kind of, we would do things like have competitions to see who could make like a little, hook up a battery to a little motor and see if you could make kind of like a boat that kind of just goes around the pool or something like that, in the bathtub. Just little things like that to just get us thinking. And then as I got older, school was kind of the biggest way. Like school library was really the only place there was a computer that I could use. School clubs, I mean, you pointed out robotics. That was a big kind of turning point for me into actually getting involved in technology. When I was in the sixth grade, I moved here to New York, and they had a robotics team, a Lego robotics. When you're that young, it's Lego. And I had been interested in Lego, but I didn't really know much about robots. I was like, okay, I'll try it out. And I got really, really engaged and involved, and it was a good environment for me to try out things and build things and you know, break things and just understand and have an appreciation for technology, even though technology wasn't necessarily a huge part of my home life.
Well, it's interesting, having heard both of you, the different approaches and the interactions that led you to where you are. And how did the two of you meet at Rensselaer? How did the three founders meet at RPI? Were you taking some of the same classes? I mean, you know, whatever your different backgrounds that brought you to RPI, how did the three of you get together?
Well, I don't know if we didn't meet in class. So our other founder, Robert, we were all in the same year. He lived in my hall freshman year, so I sort of just met him socially. And I met Sebastian. We met as well through a friend, just sort of the way you do at school through mutual acquaintances. But we really got to know each other when we decided to like form a team and do a hackathon together.
Yeah, I don't think we had any classes together before. Like, after we started hanging out, then we were like, oh, we should, like, take classes together.
Yeah.
But we didn't really, I mean, we just kind of met socially, I think. Computer science is kind of like, oh, I know a guy who programs. I know a girl who programs. Like, let's, you know, hang out and, you know, do interesting stuff.
Yeah, RPI is a technical school, obviously. So most of the people I wound up knowing freshman year were computer science students, just because there are so many of them. Not really, because I had any friends in class or anything. I mostly didn't talk to anyone.
So we are talking about school again. I'm going to ask each of you a couple questions, and we'll ask the question, and then each of you can answer. You know, our audience is diverse. There are those that are interested in gaming that are adults, and then there are also, as I said, you know, the STEM Daddy Network we try to target to promoting education, STEM education among everybody, even adults. So I'm going to ask each of you, and we'll go start with Jasmine and then Sebastian on this question. What was the single most important class that you took in high school that could be connected to where you are today? What was the most important, or the most, whether it was the content or the teacher, what was the most influential class that you took in high school, would you say?
Hard question. Honestly, I think not really a typical answer, but my AP World History class I took in 10th grade. And the teacher that I had for that class is probably the best teacher I've ever had. And he really just loved to learn and to teach, and he just made everything in class interesting. I didn't really care about history before. I was more interested in like fake history and like books and stuff. But I think when I took that class and the way he presented the material just kept me interested. I did really well in the class, and it encouraged me to take a lot harder classes in high school instead of just coasting through.
Sebastian, how about yourself?
Yeah, that's actually kind of interesting hearing that from you, because I have a very similar answer, actually. This was not organized beforehand. but yeah, in 10th grade, I had an AP Euro class that I took, and the teacher same kind of story, was very, very good. He was, he kind of respected us as students and as individuals, like as growing adults. And the course was taught in a way that was, kind of similar to the way that college was. It's aggressive, but it's not, it's the hard force of the content, but it's doable, right? And so before that, I hadn't really even been sure that I'd ever, would want to go to college. I mean, nobody in my family previously had completed college, so I would kind of be the first one to do that. And so I didn't even know if it was a path that was for me. And I felt in that course, I felt challenged, and I felt, but still supported in a way that it made me interested in pursuing college, like even at all, which was important, because it met co-founders of college, developed technical skills at college, that sort of thing. So I would say that was probably the most influential high school course that I ever took.
And Sebastian, if you were, moving forward, looking into the future and programming and where things are developing, what would you say is the most important programming language for someone to know, whether they're in high school, college, moving forward into game design and so forth? What do you think is one of the or the most important, and there may be more than one, but the important programming language?
Yeah, I think what I would say is that there are kind of a lot of different, I think the question is almost a little bit loaded in a sense, because there's computer science and programming is such a broad thing. There's so many different things that you can do with it. And I think it really depends on the way that you're trying to approach, programming, the way that you're, what problems you're trying to solve, what things are you interested in doing. So me being, relatively biased, I, like low-level stuff, hardware. I like things at lower level of the computer operating system. So I like C++. I think that's a great language to learn and understand. This is, a language that's been around for a while. So it's got the history of, computers and understanding why computers work, how they work. But it also has, look toward the future, because it's got functionality that you can build, really cool things at. But then on the other end, I would say that's good for just the foundational level of computer science. But one of the big things right now is the internet. It's been big for a while, right? So web technologies are really important, I think. I don't personally do a lot of web technologies, but I see it as a huge important part of everybody, because the world that we have right now is built on the internet, essentially. And so I think that those are really important technologies as well.
Jasmine, any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess most important. Yeah, so I think really it is kind of a loaded question, because I think the most important language to know is the one that you already know, or whatever whatever got you interested first, because it's really like programming isn't about languages. It sort of goes below that. And so the most important thing you can do is understand, what goes into a programming language and how they're all the same, and how you can get that understanding and be at a point where if you want to work on something, you have to use this language or that language you've never even heard of before, you've never used before, and you're not intimidated by that, because once you sort of understand how all of these languages work, you can just pick up any language. It's very much not like human languages where it requires years of study. It's all, they're all built on the same blocks. So I think just the ability to pick up any language is very important. And I don't think there's any one language that's really better at teaching you that. It's just whatever you've learned
Interesting.
That.
Well, reaching, and I think that that's a really good insight. And I've dabbled in programming in this past spring. I dabbled and got into some exploring more Python programming language and found it really fascinating. But I really like both your comments, and I think that, Jasmine, you have a really good thought there at the end that just go with what you're doing and know it and understand it and have fun. We're coming up here, unfortunately, near the end of the program, but I wanted to look to see if we may have some questions from any listeners. Lindsay, who is our producer. Lindsay, do we have any questions?
We do. We did have a question come in. Do either of you guys have any advice to others who want to get into the gaming or VR space?
Yeah. I mean, what I would say, I think that I've learned over the course of kind of just navigating this industry, is that it's really kind of small. Like, as much as we talk about, oh, VR is going to be worth, you know, $1 billion, you know, by 2020 or whatever, it's really kind of a small industry, and you can, you know, a lot of game studios, there's not that many game studios, and we can all be connected in interesting ways. So, I mean, once you're able to kind of break in and talk to, and everyone's really passionate, you know, so it's easy to have those conversations. It's easy to, you know, be passionate about a game and talk with, you know, somebody about it and get involved in whatever level you want to do it, whether it's making a game or whether it's being the business side of the game, marketing it, or just being, you know, enthused about, you know, a particular game in general. I think the biggest lesson I've learned is that the industry is so small that it's accessible. It's very accessible.
Jasmine, thoughts?
Yeah, so I guess we actually have people ask us similar stuff a lot, like about whether it's like making a new game or starting a company. And I think this is kind of vague advice, but I think the most important thing is to find the line between, you know, doing what you think you should do and doing what other people think you should do, because people will always tell you, you know, your idea is great and it's going to be the best ever, or your idea is terrible and no one likes it. And if you follow everyone's advice, it's always going to conflict and you're going to wind up with like absolutely nothing, because you're just doing the opposite of, you know, what you just were doing last week. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to make something that no one's going to like. So you can't just shut yourself in the dark and not listen to anyone's advice. So, but really, if I had an answer for, you know, what the exact line to toe is, I'd have a lot of money right now. So I don't know. But it's definitely somewhere in between those two extremes is the place to be.
Yeah, and I think that it's oftentimes hard to find that, but at the same time, following the kind of approach that you answered, it's easy as well. I mean, I think that it's remaining true to yourself, listening to others, taking in what people have to say, but going with your gut feeling, and because ultimately you have to be passionate about what you're doing and do what you want to do. And as you said, you know, listen to people. If there are a lot of, nobody wants what you're doing, then, you know, it maybe listen to that and absorb that and rethink it. But at the same time, don't let people tell you not to do something that there just may not be a market for yet. You know, that's Steve Jobs. It's to allude at the end of the conversation here. He was probably one of the best out there through Apple to, you know, in his latter phase with Apple, with the iPhone and so forth, and iPad, is to create a product where there wasn't a market yet for it, and by creating the product, create the marketplace for it. It's hard to do that, and that's at that extreme, and I don't think any of us are saying to shoot for that necessarily, but if somebody's really committed, really enthusiastic, don't let others deter you completely from what your gut is telling you, because you may be right. You may be wrong, but so much of everything, our lives, so much of technology, businesses, startups, is built on learning from failure. So failure should not be something that we fear, but rather understanding it, it might be an inevitable result of learning and going to the next step. So I think great comments for both of you. We are just about running out of time here, as I've said. And before we go, though, I'd like to circle back. You said that you had kids and scouts come through, and whether that's kids, scouts, or somebody else, how do they get in contact with Ilium VR to discuss those possibilities? Or if somebody else is an intern at RPI or somebody is listening and wanting to be involved and help out, who should they contact and how do they do so?
Yeah, there are a couple of different ways to contact us. The easiest one is probably the most direct is we have just a general email address, info@iliumvr.com. But, you know, we're relatively responsive on Facebook or Twitter or other things like that. So pretty much there are a lot of communication mediums by which we can be reached with emails, a really good one, and social media as well.
Do either of you or both have any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
I would just like to say, you know, thanks for having us really, really kind of enjoyed this conversation. It was really good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
You're quite welcome, both. Sebastian Sabora and Jasmine Ollinger of Ilium VR, I want to thank you both for taking the time to spend with me and the listeners of Gaming Chords today. I really appreciate it, and I'm really excited to see where you're going, and hopefully the next time I'm through Troy, New York, we'll have to get together and maybe I can get a tour of your facilities, because that somewhat intrigued me as we were discussing. So thanks again for being a part of Gaming Chords. Gaming Chords is part of the Stem Daddy and Network. That's just your show. Stem Voice. This is Charles Mudd, the host of Gaming Chords. And until we meet again, be well, and maybe I'll see you in a game online.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.